Omaha Public Radio presents another program from Bellevue University on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by nationally renowned novelist and Omaha native Ron Hansen, author of Desperados, The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford, and the National Book Award-winning novel Atticus. Mr. Hansen, the Gerard Manley Hopkins S.J. Professor in the Department of English at Santa Clara University in California, will deliver the keynote address at Bellevue University's Celebration of Student Writing and Research, wherein over 80 students were honored for excellence in academic writing. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Monday morning, May 18, 2009, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Bellevue University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Tony Jasnowski, Director of the Writing Senate at Bellevue University.
Now I have the great privilege to introduce to you our keynote speaker for the 2009 Celebration of Student Writing and Research, Mr. Ron Hansen, who one critic has described as one of our finest stylists of American historical fiction. And another critic has had this to say about Mr. Hansen's abilities. Hansen writes with a sure hand about the inner lives of people struggling to find themselves in a confusing world. His prose is at once straightforward and seductive. We are mesmerized as riddles beget further riddles, and layers of the story begin to peel away. Ron Hansen is a native son of Omaha, Nebraska. He attended Creighton Prep High School, where, I've learned, his skill as a writer was first recognized and developed. His freshman English teacher would allow students to earn extra credit by writing short stories, which Mr. Hansen did to great success. Following high school, Mr. Hansen graduated from Creighton University with a bachelor's degree in English literature, and then he spent 2 years as a lieutenant in the Army during the Vietnam War. After leaving the Army, he earned his MFA in creative writing from the Iowa Writers' Workshop at the University of Iowa, studying under John Cheever and John Irving. Mr. Hansen published his first novel, Desperados, in 1979, while a Jones lecturer in writing at Stanford University. Since then, he has held numerous teaching positions at universities around the country while publishing his subsequent work, which includes The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford in 1983, a book of stories entitled Nebraska in 1989, and the novels Marriott in Ecstasy in 1991, Atticus in 1996, Hitler's Niece in 1999, and the screwball comedy Isn't It Romantic in 2003. And his most recent novel is Exiles, which considers the life of the British Jesuit poet Gerard Manley Hopkins and the 1875 shipwreck of the Deutschland, which inspired one of his masterpieces. He has completed a new collection of stories, She Loves Me Not, and is at work on a new novel. Mr. Hansen has received numerous fellowships from various foundations and was twice a finalist for the Penn Faulkner Award for The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford and for Atticus. He was also a finalist for the 1997 National Book Award for Atticus. Marriott in Ecstasy won the Fiction Prize from the Bay Area Book Reviewers Association and the Gold Medal for Excellence in Fiction from the Commonwealth Club of California. Three of his novels have been adapted for film, Marriott in Ecstasy, Atticus, and most recently The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford, which was released in 2007 and which starred Brad Pitt and Casey Affleck. Mr. Hansen has been awarded honorary doctorates from several different colleges and universities, including just 48 hours ago from Loyola College in Baltimore, and I think next at end of this week he's getting another doctorate. He currently serves as the Gerard Manley Hopkins Professor in Arts and Humanities at Santa Clara University. I'll let the last words of my introduction of Mr. Hansen come from, be inspired rather, by something that he himself has written, something from his essay entitled, What Stories Are and Why We Read Them. Near the end of that essay, he writes, Willa Cather once said that first-rate writers cannot be defined. They can only be experienced. She meant that their greatness was not in the formal features of their writing, but on the salutary effect their stories have on our hearts and minds. John Gardner wrote that the great artist, the genius, to use the old-fashioned word, is the writer who sees more connections between things than ordinary people can see. If Willa Cather and John Gardner were still with us today, I'm sure that they would agree with me that Mr. Ron Hansen is one of the great artists and first-rate writers working in America today. Please join me in welcoming Mr. Ron Hansen to the stage.
Thank you. thank you for that glorious introduction, and thank you for your presence here today. It's really an honor to be at Bellevue University and back in my old hometown. I'm going to read an essay called Making Things Up. In one of Garrison Keillor's monologues on his Prairie Home Companion radio show, he says, "Well, it's been a quiet week in Lake Wobegon, Minnesota, my hometown out there on the edge of the prairie. Most of the leaves are off the trees. Of course, the corn is all combined, the beans as well. The fields are mostly just stubble. It's a November landscape, a reminder to all of us to look for our warm things and to get ourselves a good windshield scraper. When the big storm comes in a week or two, you don't want to have to be scraping the ice off your windshield with your credit card. It would look like you weren't from here. It's a good time, winter, for all of us. It's a time when all the things that we've been postponing for months can now be put off for a good while longer. All those improvement projects, including self-improvement, those can be put off until spring because winter brings us back to basics, food and heat, and of course the obligation that we all have to tell stories, which is why God put us here after all. That is, to live rich, full lives and then to tell about it, or better yet, to know other people who have lived rich, full lives and tell stories about them." My first memory is a scene in the kitchen of our home on Fowler Street in Omaha. I was in my first year in a high chair adjacent to my mother, and my twin brother Rob was in a high chair facing her. At the far end of the kitchen table, sunlight filling the window behind her, was my sister Ginny, 7 years older than Rob and me, and notoriously antagonistic to vegetables of all sorts. My mother was spoon-feeding my brother and me something dark green from a Gerber's bottle, mashed peas or spinach or whatever. And Ginny, holding back a grimace, asked my mother if the boys really liked that stuff. My mother said they seemed to eat almost everything. And I was struck, at the age of one, without, of course, comprehending what I'd learned, that the English language had been a kind of wild snowstorm around me until then. But whether my sister or mother recognized it or not, I now understood every word they said. Many years, indeed decades later, I found myself wondering why I so clearly remembered that kitchen scene, until at a dinner party, a lady friend who was a psychiatrist told me that language acquisition is the first step in the separation between children and their mothers. And I had stamped in my mind a primal scene in which that differentiation became luminous. Rob and I, as twins, worked out a language of our own as many twins do. My father's father had made us a play table so that we faced each other with our wooden blocks and toys, and my mother would duck her head into our bedroom to hear us happily chattering away in words completely invented, but which we understood. When we were four or so, we were heading to downtown Omaha and about to bump over the railroad tracks beside the Nabisco factory. I turned to Rob and said a word like whorehound, which meant railroad train to us, and perhaps was a child's imitation of the wailing noise of a locomotive as it approached a crossroads. My mother turned in the front seat of our car and asked with honest curiosity, "What does that word mean? You always say it here." We both stared forward, saying nothing, gun-shy, and that was the last time I can remember speaking our invented language. I now have forgotten our secret vocabulary, and I regret it. My first grade teacher was Sister Clyda, a harried Dominican nun at Holy Angels Grade School, who was serving her purgatory time here on earth in a classroom of 32 hyper children, some of whom were incompletely housebroken. And as comedian Bill Cosby has pointed out, all children are brain damaged. One afternoon, Sister Clyda taught us some basic arithmetic and introduced us to the concept of a quiz on the material she just covered. We were handed out half sheets of lined paper and were supposed to solve the addition problem she chalked on the blackboard. Well, just the night before that particular test, I had learned to fold and fly a paper airplane. And that sleek craft, yawing and banking in fluent flight, seemed to me far more interesting than the resolution of 4 plus 2. She sidled down the crammed aisles of the classroom, collecting the quizzes, and I handed over my paper airplane with such gleeful innocence that she thought at first it was sarcasm. And even in seeing it, she blew, as they say, a gasket. Her red face and sharp scolding revealed I had pushed her to the brink, and I suppose, fearing that she might do me harm, she took me by the hand and marched me across the hallway to the 7th grade classroom. There the nun who was teaching accepted me with calm, and my sister Ginny scowled as I smugly took a seat in a big kid's desk, my feet dangling from off the floor, and my folded arms as high as my chin. I could not understand anything the nun there was talking about, but I felt I'd scored a major victory and skipped 6 grades with that paper airplane. I knew it was a snazzy invention. I just knew it. After an hour, when the older nun thought it safe, I was conveyed back to my 1st grade class, and the pacified Sister Clyda said nothing to me. I was happy, content, with zero remorse for my grand adventure, and getting away with that had more than a little to do with my becoming a fiction writer. The fiction I write seems to me merely grown-up versions of paper airplanes. Although I grew up in this city, there were still pockets of agrarian culture in North Omaha, and half block from my house were cornfields, railroad tracks, and the Snell Sash and Door Company, where there were forts of wooden pallets and where empty, wonderfully available railway boxcars waited for their freight. All these were ideal hangouts for boys. We dug foxholes and patrolled for Nazis like the characters in Combat, ate wild mulberries and sunflower seeds, clambered all over those boxcars, and had our pennies flattened on the rails by passing locomotives. Once a railroad detective caught us and sent my father a letter warning of the mortal dangers of doing what we were doing. My father tried to reprimand us, but we could tell his heart wasn't really in it. Railroad tracks, he knew, were just so cool. But gradually, we boys got to an age when that make-believe world seemed like kid stuff, even unmanly, and it was about then that a nun at Holy Angels assigned us the written homework of an essay on the crucifixion. I instinctively realized I hadn't wanted to analyze it or quote sources on it. I wanted to write about the crucifixion as if I actually were there on Golgotha, and I had the temerity to raise my hand and ask if that was possible. Sister Pierce seemed confused at first, but since I was the only kid who'd requested to write fiction instead of an essay, she didn't think it would be a problem. I produced a short story very much like Ernest Hemingway's very bad short play, Today is Friday, which I hadn't yet read, about Roman soldiers who witnessed Jesus dying on the cross and speaking about it over grappa later on. I tell you, he was pretty good in there today, a Roman soldier says in Hemingway's playlet, and my version was no less artful and realistic. But I had discovered a way to indulge a desire that seemed peculiar only to me, the desire to make things up, essentially to improve on the life I had experienced either through reading or being knocked about as we all are. It is a kind of line, of course, but for the good of the characters, for the good of the audience, and for the good of the soul of the author. In writing about his own poems in a book of essays, The Glass Anvil, Andrew Hudgens mentions the quandary poets and fiction writers face in making things up. "I'm always astonished," he writes, "at how falsely I remember things, astonished at how plastic memory is. And even when I know a memory is incorrect, part of my brain cleaves to the wrong, imagined memory. And now I hold two images in my head, two memories. And the false one is more vivid and more emotionally significant to me than the actual one. Which, then, is the truest memory? It's convenient when the actual events adequately convey the emotional experience, but sometimes they don't, and the writer has to choose." Often the choice devolves to which version provides the juicier words, for crucial to the urge to write is an interest in the English language that for me probably had its roots in the secret language Rob and I shared as twins. Etymologies fascinated me, and one of my grander moments in high school occurred when, in my illicit reading, a book open on my knees but hidden out of view of the teacher, I fell upon the word onomatopoeia, which is defined as the formation of a word by imitation of the sound to which it refers, such as bang, boom, and cuckoo. I couldn't remember ever having seen such a strange word before, so I puzzled over it for a while. The next thing I knew, the English teacher at Creighton Preparatory School, a layman then in his 20s named Mr. Schaefer, was giving us our weekend reading assignment. A classmate, Mickey Deasing, complained that the weather was going to be beautiful and the homework difficult. Couldn't Mr. Schaefer just let us off just this once? And the sporty teacher negotiated a deal with us. Our class could pick one person, and the teacher could pick a word. If that student could spell it, we'd have no homework for the weekend. You probably see where this is heading. To my surprise and trepidation, the class picked me, chanting, "Hansen, Hansen." And so I became the chosen one. And Mr. Schaefer, already clearly complacent about his victory, chose the most difficult word he knew. "All right, Mr. Hansen," he said, "spell onomatopoeia." I couldn't believe the luck. And when I correctly spelled the word out, Mr. Schaefer said, "Shit." And my high school classroom erupted in wild hoots and cheers. A measure of how miraculous that seemed to one classmate is that he recorded the anecdote in a book of favorite memories for our 30th class reunion. I've had the good fortune to be rewarded financially for my writing, and yet I'm certain I would continue making things up even if I were like Emily Dickinson or Franz Kafka or Gerard Manley Hopkins, writing only for an audience of a few close friends. There's a joy in the simple making of things, for creativity, as Ignatius of Loyola pointed out, is a participation in the divine. But I think there's something else going on. In his spiritual exercises, Ignatius invented a helpful method for meditating on Scripture and drawing profit from it. Each hour's meditation is done in the same way. We begin with a preparatory prayer, and as a prelude to the meditation, consider the history of the subject, such as Jesus appearing to seven of his disciples as they fished. Reading the gospel passage several times until we can develop a mental representation of the locale and the people in it. We then ask for grace. In this case, it is to be consoled at seeing Christ on the shore and to feel the joy and comfort of his resurrection. We see the fishermen hauling in their nets in the Sea of Galilee, hear the smack of waves against the boat's hull, feel the sunshine on our skins, smell seaweed and mackerel, taste the water we scoop up in our palm. With all five senses wholly engaged, we can be as shocked and happy as Peter was when he recognized who was the risen Christ, who was roasting a fish on a charcoal fire on the shore, and plunged into the sea to wade to him. We hear Christ's instruction to Peter, and we also enter in the conversation, or as Ignatius put it, colloquy, inquiring perhaps on how we ourselves can feed his sheep, or just saying like Peter, "Lord, you know that I love you." We finish the meditation period with a standard prayer, such as the Our Father, and usually exercitants keep a journal in which they describe what happened in their prayer and its effect on them. But for me and many others I've guided as a spiritual director is when we go beyond what is written in the gospel scene and freely imagine other conversations or activities with Christ, that we have the fullest sense of his love for us and is concerned over the most humdrum events in our lives. The job we're seeking, the sinful temptations that persecute us, the strains and worries we all share. So it is when I'm writing fiction. A subject first mysteriously presents itself to me as one I need to deal with, a story I have to tell. One by one, fictional scenes occur to me like many stair steps to an upper room. Seeing, hearing, and feeling the locale, the weather, and the characters enables me to become a participant in each scene. And no matter the topic, my own emotional, psychological, or spiritual concerns are highlighted or weeded out. I solve issues not in the random, chaotic way of dreaming, but through orderly focus and conjecture. A like experience happens as we read. For whether we're aware of it or not, we're making things up just as the author is, putting faces on those who have not been described, filling in the details left out, questioning what we would do in those circumstances, or recalling times when we were vexed in just that way. The Irish novelist John McGahern once said that church services were his first book. What he meant was the theater of the rites and the spare poetry, the spoken texts, excited his imagination just as a children's book does. But without the nonsense rhymes and feel-good notions that well-meaning parents and educators sometimes insist upon. I have been a guest at some 12-step meetings and have been struck by the earthy, frank, hair-raising, and sometimes hilarious reminiscences of men and women who are coming to terms with their disease. The confessions are ways of repenting for a history of excesses, establishing transparency, reforming one's own life by connecting it with others while disconnecting it from the past and sharing in the sheer gift of recovery. Hearing those acts of reconciliation reminds me of Garrison Keillor's insistence on the obligation we have to tell stories. We sit around a kitchen table or huddle over cups of coffee or queue up for a movie ticket, and as we confess or joke or prevaricate with each other, we form a kind of community. There are grander things we can aspire to, magnificent projects we can take on, but it is the holiness of the ordinary that I think, what fiction writers and poets of the 21st century are called to notice and seek out. On the first page of Look, Homeward Angel, Thomas Wolfe has it that each of us is all the sums he has not counted. Subtract us into nakedness and night again, and you shall see begin in Crete 4,000 years ago the love that ended yesterday in Texas. The seed of our destruction will blossom in the desert. The elixir of our cure grows by a mountain rock, and our lives are haunted by a Georgia slattern because a London cutpurse went unhung. Each moment on earth is the fruit of 40,000 years and more. Instinctively, we know that. And so we all tell each other stories to remember, entertain, console, repent, inspire, and in 100 other ways, flesh out our roles in the great drama of civilization.
I have a son who's a freshman at Creighton Prep. Is your old teacher still there? And if not, do you have any tips for him on how to start writing better?
Oh, you know, I thought a lot of the advice was given earlier by all the speakers was really excellent. And I think it's particularly important to do all kinds of writing. That writing begets other writing, and even letters are good for producing fiction, and fiction is good for writing nonfiction. All of the facility with the language comes just through the practice of it. And as one of the speakers said, you have to read a lot, read everything. When I was a freshman, I think, in high school, I started reading the novels of Irving Wallace. And I don't know if anybody reads Irving Wallace anymore, but he was a big best-selling writer at the time. And I was aware that there weren't great literature, but because he was a little clumsier at his writing, the bones stuck out more, and I could see how a plot was developed. And in some ways, reading popular fiction is probably better for a young writer than reading literary fiction, because literary fiction, the people are so skilled that it seems effortless, and you don't see how everything's put together, whereas popular fiction, it's much easier to see how everything was assembled, and you also it gives you the impression that I could do this, I can write better than that. One of my first memories in high school was realizing I wasn't a very good writer, but knowing that if I kept at it, I could get better. And I think that's really important, is the people who really want to do good things eventually do them, even if they're not particularly good at it to begin with. I know Mickey Mantle became a great hitter because his father just made him hit his pitching over and over again. They would hit, 100 balls a night, and that's how he became a great hitter. Butch Harmon, who used to be Tiger Woods' golf coach, said that, you can be as good as Tiger Woods, you just have to hit 600 balls every day. And that's the problem. Most people just don't have that stick-to-itiveness. So all of you here have persisted in some way in your writing, or you wouldn't be honored. And if you keep at it, continue at it, you will get better. I think there's no question that the perseverance pays off. And Publishing is a profession that rewards those who actually stay at it for a while. Your first book might come out and not get good reviews, but if you keep at it, you'll get better, and eventually you'll get good reviews, probably, or you'll find your audience and not need a review. I don't know, does Stephen King even get reviewed? I don't know, but he sells millions of books anyway. I think I answered that question. I'm rambling now. Okay.
I'd be interested to hear your comments on how your style has evolved since you started, and also how you see that evolution in other authors, whether this is an ongoing process as our society changes and, you know, I hate to say dumbing down, but does the writing you're reading, you're seeing now, reflect the audience out there?
John Irving told me that his style has changed simply because he's become so popular in Europe. And when he writes a sentence, he always thinks, how is that going to be translated into a foreign language? And so he leaves out some words that won't be translated well. So he's actually simplified his prose style quite a bit. When I'm writing, I have an idea for a story or something like that, and then I have to choose what kind of style to write it in. Maybe for other people, all the styles look the same, but for me, they're really individual voices, even if I'm doing it in third person. But it's I think, is this a Raymond Carver type of story? Is this a John Cheever type of story? Well, or Ernest Hemingway? I choose the style that way. I was telling Tony that I had a story about this Polish priest who was in Menlo Park when I saw him, and he was in trouble in Poland. It was when the KGB was involved with Solidarity, Solidarność, and he had come to the United States because he was on a hit list by the KGB. But while he was in the United States, he was followed around by this spy. And I thought it was really, and he said, talked about how he felt kind of, at one point the spy disappeared and he never saw him again. And he said how much he missed him because he realized that that spy was the only one he knew who spoke Polish. And I thought that was such a great story, and I heard it like in 1981, and I just kept it in my head for a long, long time because I didn't know how to solve it. And then I finally read this reminiscence of this priest who was from Poland who ended up going to Alaska as a missionary, and he wrote a kind of reminiscence, and he wanted the editor of the newsletter to correct his English, but the editor thought it was charming, so he left all the inappropriate grammar or bad word choices all the way through there. And once I saw his prose style, the story came instantly to mind, and I wrote it very quickly after that. But it was something has to trip a story into being, and that was that guy's language itself that did it. I always kind of describe story writing, and I guess it's true for poetry writing as well, or a lot of anything where you make it up, as kind of a chemical reaction where you have all these various elements and they're just sitting there in kind of a nascent state, inert. But then some other chemical comes in and they kind of explode into something. And you have to get all these various things together at the same time for it to actually happen. So consequently, I always have lots of stories I mean to write, but I'm waiting for that little chemical reaction to come into being. Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from Bellevue University on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Ron Hansen, author of Desperados, The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford, and the National Book Award-winning novel Atticus. Mr. Hansen, the Gerard Manley Hopkins S.J. Professor in the Department of English at Santa Clara University in California, has delivered the keynote address at Bellevue University's Celebration of Student Writing and Research, wherein over 80 students were honored for excellence in academic writing. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Monday morning, May 18, 2009, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Jason Keyes, Assistant Director of Public Relations at Bellevue University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.